Welcome back.
A los hombres del ejército matan a sus mismos hermanos campesinos. De nada sirven las reformas si van teñidas con tanta sangre. Les suplico, cese la represión.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Gang members in Central America's northern triangle of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras are members hasta la morgue. In other words, the only way out is in a pine box. There is one exception, salvation through the evangelical church. There, the tattooed homies trade in one identity and sense of belonging to become hermanos, or brothers in Christ. It's a difficult and dangerous conversion, and one that made sociologist Robert Brenneman curious. He sat down with more than 60 former gang members and spoke to psychologists, priests, and prison guards to research his book, Homies and Hermanos, God and Gangs in Central America. Robert Brenneman is assistant professor of sociology at St. Michael's College in Vermont, where we reached him. Robert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, fascinating book. First of all, we should distinguish the gangs that you were talking about from the Central American drug cartels. What is the distinction there?
A huge difference is the kind of social strata from which young gang members derive. They do get involved often in the drug trade, but usually as low-level players, sometimes in the employ of the larger Mexican drug cartels. So these are neighborhood-based youth gangs with some transnational connections between cells.
Yet they are transnational gangs. And you trace the origins of the transnational gangs actually to the U.S. Can we get a little thumbnail sketch of the origins of the largest and most powerful gangs, the MS, the Mara Salvatrucha, and the original Mexican gang, 18, or the 18th Street Gang?
Yeah, and I would only clarify that it's a Mexican-American street gang, the 18th Street, and the MS-13 is a Salvadoran-American gang. So already you have a kind of transnational identity there. Both the Salvatrucha and the 18 were sort of born in the American Southwest among immigrant groups in sort of marginalized neighborhoods of East L.A. and elsewhere. After the Rodney King riots of 1992, the LAPD really cracked down on immigrant youth with any sort of criminal record and began deporting Salvadoran Americans by the thousands. And they began colonizing the local street gangs, first Salvadoran street gangs, and then they proceeded to cross the borders into Honduras and Guatemala. And so really that led to the flourishing of Mara Salvatrucha and the 18th Street Gang.
This book is about what seems like a very drastic reversal of identity from becoming a gang member to an evangelical or Pentecostal Christian. Do we have any idea how many former gang members make that conversion?
I don't. I wish I did. Even though I did not screen all of the 64 young men and women that I interviewed about religion, most of them had converted after leaving the gang or as a pathway out of the gang. So I think it's quite common, but I don't have a way of being able to say about this proportion of ex-gang members are evangelical or Pentecostal Christians.
But we get portraits of several of them through your book. Many members are afraid for their lives after leaving the gang. You write that your Guatemalan-born wife was very afraid for you. It's a very scary situation. How did you find these members to interview, and where did you arrange to meet them?
It depended on each country. I had a lot of contacts in Guatemala because I had lived there for 6 years in the late 90s and early 2000s. In El Salvador, I just looked up organizations that I knew worked in youth violence reduction, and they gave me leads. And in terms of the spaces where to meet in Guatemala, I worked a lot at the tattoo removal clinic where they were very gracious. In Salvador, I didn't have much space of my own, so I would go to places like a middle-class Mexican restaurant in a very kind of public area. And I learned sort of the hard way that not everybody felt as comfortable there because for example, one of the young men, Uvaldo, that I interviewed, I took him to buy him a breakfast at this place, and I realized early on that he wasn't very comfortable in this middle-class kind of restaurant because he noticed people watching him. And after the interview was over, Ubaldo asked me, "Can you tell?" he said. "Do I still look like a gang member?"
Hmm.
And I lied to him. I said, no, what are you talking about? But I had noticed the people looking too. And he said, "I've been trying so hard. I've been trying to relearn how to walk, how to talk, wow, how to dress, what to say." And some of this is just class, social class, but some of it is learning to lose the gang manner. And that takes years to do. And in some ways, that's what evangelical churches offer, is a kind of re-socialization program and a way to offer these young men a kind of new identity that is non-threatening, even to non-gang members. There are polls that show as much as 60% of Guatemalans approve of social cleansing, that is the elimination of gang members as a means of dealing with gang violence. And so these guys know that they have targets on their head, sometimes almost literally because of their tattoos, and they need a way, they need access to safety, and evangelical churches to a certain degree provide that.
And it does strike me there is a common sense of belonging either in the gang, in the church, even though they come from such different places. But let's trace back to some of the common reasons why people from the barrio, often kids, get drawn into the gangs. Now, while you do point out that some of the narratives that people have about this are not entirely correct, but maybe we should hear it through a story. You spoke to Juan José Gómez Tobar, a 28-year-old Guatemalan ex-gang member. He got in when he was less than 9 years old. Give us a little bit about his story. We call him JJ in the book.
Yeah, JJ is a remarkable individual. I always started my interviews with the question, "Tell me how you ended up in a gang." And JJ told me the story of having watched his father die when he was 8 and having been moved to the city with his very abusive older brother. And he met a gang, older kids, when he was 9 years old. Almost as a dare, these older boys loaned him a weapon and said, "Go rob that corner store." And JJ went to the corner store and aiming the gun at the man behind the counter. And he said, when I told him to give me the money in your cash register, the guy laughed at me because I was just a kid. And he said, when he laughed at me, I saw in his face the face of my abusive older brother. And I started screaming at him, "Give me the money in your cash register right now or I'll kill you." And the man said, all right, here you go. Get out of here, but don't kill me." I use that example because it illustrates the way in which young gang members are able to turn their sense of shame as victims of abuse into a kind of resource for anger and violence. But of course, the shame returns often when no one's around to be impressed or humiliated. And that's what I call the shame spiral. Escaping even for a moment by means of violence is one of the great attractions of the gang for these youth.
So explain to us, Professor Brenneman, why the evangelical and Pentecostal movements more appealing for gang members than the traditional Catholic Church, which for so long, you know, cast such a long shadow in Central America. Are they more appealing or maybe more welcoming?
Yeah, certainly more appealing. I wouldn't want to say that Catholic churches as a whole don't open their doors to gang youth or former gang youth, but certainly the evangelical Pentecostal churches are more appealing, and I think that's in part because of their theology. Their most attractive religious good is that of transformation, and all evangelicals make a strong claim that Jesus can save anyone, and transform them, and therefore no one is beyond hope. And they also, the churches themselves, have a lot at stake in bringing in gang members because that really validates their own theology that Jesus can save anyone and that this is a place of transformation. This religious system or this religious community is a kind of, almost like a body shop, a place for fixing up, changing, and restoring an identity. And really, you know, in one of the roughest corners of globalization.
Well, the oath that many of these gang members take is to be married to the gang hasta morgue. Is that how I say it?
Hasta la morgue, yeah.
Hasta la morgue.
All the way to the morgue.
All the way to the morgue. You speak with a Guatemalan psychiatrist who treats incarcerated gang who says, you know, how do you get out? Take them to another planet. Is the church offering a way out? And I guess the follow-on question would be, how genuine are these conversions?
Yeah, and that's the question I wrestle with in the book. The ex-gang member converts reported converting for different reasons, but often there was this strategic side to it. One ex-gang member convert said, I couldn't see any other way out, and the church seemed like the best option. It was almost like he was describing this very rational choice. Others described a very different kind of conversion that caught them off guard when they were overwhelmed by a sermon on a street corner or in an institution or something. That I would want to question the idea that a true conversion, if it's genuine, shouldn't have any pragmatic or strategic or rational side to it. There's a mix of motives, probably when anyone converts. So I wouldn't want to pit strategy and genuineness against each other necessarily.
And JJ, who we spoke of earlier, ends up marrying the mother of his children, seemingly beginning a very different life than the one he used to lead. Now, besides falling out of the church, are you concerned? Are you worried about the lifespan of these former gang members? I mean, when you go back 2 or 3 years from now, do you expect JJ and the others that you spoke to still be alive?
Yeah, well, I really profoundly hope that as many of them as possible still are alive. But I, if I had to make predictions, I'm not sure I would say that. One of the young men that I interviewed, a very articulate, really bright young man who was trying hard to turn his life around, Antonio, was killed 6 weeks after I interviewed him in Guatemala City. But JJ walks around with an oxygen tank now. He can't hold down his jobs because he took a bullet in the lungs a few years ago. You know, how long will he last? He's pretty confident that he's respected in his neighborhood, but when he leaves the neighborhood, it's a risk. For that reason, he wears long sleeves so that no one sees the tattoos on his arms. But he can't hide the tattoos on his eyelids. He has some concern for his life whenever he goes out.
Well, some powerful stories. I really want to thank you so much, Robert Brenneman, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Robert Brenneman, assistant professor of sociology at St. Michael's College in Vermont. He sat down with more than 60 former gang members from the Northern Triangle of Central America to research his book, Homies and Hermanos, God and Gangs in Central America. You can find out more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up on Word of Mouth, P.J. O'Rourke used to cover war zones. He doesn't miss the job, but rather reenacts it on a series of family vacations and other pleasure trips. P.J. O'Rourke's Holidays in Heck. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Siguiendo cada efecto, correcto o incorrecto, se aprende todo al respecto. Saber que algunas personas quieren el daño, subir peldaño toma tiempo, toma año. Con mi peluche mirándolo cotidiano.